It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. And before we get started with the main portion of the show, I wanted to talk about something new and exciting. I have recently founded a new nonprofit called Responsible Eating and Living, and it's an opportunity to get involved really intensely with all the things that I am so passionate about, and I welcome you to visit the new site, responsibleeatingandliving.com, responsibleeatingandliving.com. One of the things I love about the name is the acronym, which is REAL, and we'll be doing lots of video programming, including food shows, news. There's already quite a few recipes and pictures of some great food items. Of course, everything is plant-based, and many of the recipes are gluten-free. And so some of the recipes that I talk about on It's All About Food, as well as on my other show, Sunday Ask a Vegan, I will be putting up the details on this site, responsibleeatingandliving.com. So please check it out, and there'll be lots of opportunity for responses, for feedback, and so I hope to hear from you there. So today we have really a wonderful guest, Dr. Will Tuttle, and he has inspired so many people with his work. Specifically, the book that he wrote that came out several years ago, The World Peace Diet. Dr. Will Tuttle is an award-winning speaker, educator, author, and musician. His music, writings, and presentations focus on creativity, intuition, and compassion. And his book, The World Peace Diet, has been called one of the most important books of the 21st century, the foundation of a new society based on the truth of the interconnectedness of life. Will, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen. We're delighted to be here on the show.
Yeah, I'm so glad we could work this out because I know you have a busy schedule and you're everywhere.
Right. One place at a time, but a lot of different places. We're in Palm Springs at the moment.
Is it hot?
It's actually, it's pretty warm, although it's overcast, so it's not too bad.
Well, for those who aren't familiar with Will Tuttle and his book, The World Peace Diet, you have really dedicated your life to this mission, this beautiful mission of making this world a better place.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think you're also doing the same thing. I think we're working pretty much on the same team here to try and raise consciousness about the ramifications of our food choices. Especially.
Okay, but your home is a moving target.
Right. We have a rolling home. It's parked here at the church. We are getting all our energy from the sun. We have solar panels on the roof. And, it's a fifth-wheel trailer. We've been living in it, my wife Madeline and I, for now about 16 years.
16 years?
Yeah.
Now, most people could not and would not do that.
Well, it's a small space. You know, mm-hmm. It has some advantages. If I want a new pair of pants, I've got to give away a pair of pants. So I can't store a bunch of things. But, yeah, it's about 220 square feet, I guess, we've been living in. But it's really fun. We enjoy it. We don't feel like we're giving up a whole heck of a lot because, like you were saying, we really are dedicated to spreading the message, and this is a good way to do it because we're able to give lots of events, over 150 events a year around North America, and lectures and presentations, concerts and workshops and things, focusing on helping people to see more deeply into the implications of our food choices and to help connect with health and compassion, sustainability, and the big picture.
How did you first decide to live this way? I'm curious.
Well, we, you know, actually, I was teaching college back in San Francisco in the 80s, and I really loved it, but I got a 1971 Volkswagen bus, decided to try living in that and traveling, and did a walk, actually, that people were doing from Santa Monica to New York City called Global Walk for a Livable World back in 1990, and after that moved into my Volkswagen bus and lived in that for 3 years while I traveled and did workshops and concerts. And then I met Madeline in Switzerland, and we moved into a little house in Northern California for a few years while we made albums. And I felt, though, it was time for a change, and we decided to try living in an RV. I never really thought we would do it. We thought we would try it for a few months, and that was 16 years ago. It really works out great for us, and we enjoy it. And so we just, one of those stories, we just thought we'd try it for a little while, and we're still doing it.
Here you are. Well, that's a good one. Now, you have a website, willtuttle.com.
Yes. Yeah, and that has our schedule on it. If anyone wants to see where we are, where we'll be coming, where we'll be presenting, if you have friends in certain cities around the country. If you're interested in having us come to where you are, just send me an email. We really try to make loops around North America and include as many of the different corners as we can. So we've been pretty much to every state and done things over the last few years. And we have the music and the art as well as information about the World Peace Diet and downloads and videos and all kinds of stuff like that, too.
Now, how many years ago now did the World Peace Diet come out?
It came out at the end of 2005, so it's been just about 5 years, and we're just now in the sixth year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we've seen some significant change, I think, since that book came out. Some positive change.
Right. I think we've definitely seen a lot of change. I think we've seen positive change in terms of the vegan message reaching more and more people in the mainstream. And I think we're seeing some definite positive changes happening in terms of people's awareness about the ramifications for their health. The idea that diabetes, osteoporosis, and heart disease and cancer are pretty strongly linked to eating diets high in animal-based foods is getting more and more traction through the work of a lot of people. And we're working with those ideas, but even more, I think, with the idea that our cultural health, our spiritual and psychological health, and the environmental health, too, are very powerfully affected by our food choices, probably more than anything else. And the World Peace Diet message is essentially about our psychological, spiritual, and cultural health, that we need to understand how our violence towards animals for food boomerangs in ways that are not only devastating to the animals themselves, but into the whole webs of life that we share on this planet, but really to our culture, our relationships, our own inner peace, you know, all these things are really affected.
Well, I'm a believer. There's no question there. I was reading recently, I think it was a Lebanese journalist who happened to be in Manhattan, and she was surprised to see one of these protests. You know, we have these horse-drawn carriages in Manhattan, and a lot of tourists take advantage of them, and there's a number of groups that are trying to get rid of this tradition because the horses are so poorly treated. And it's really, in the winter, it's terrible because the horses are so cold, and in the summer, it's horrible because they're parched and so hot, and it's a sad thing, but it's really a very small piece of a very cruel big picture puzzle.
Right.
And what this woman remarked was, how fortunate we are here in this country where we have the luxury to be focused on animal rights, whereas in the Middle East right now, so many people are struggling for human rights. But like you say, it's all connected. It really
right.
all is the same thing. And I would like to think that when all of these other people that are so focused on their own misfortune finally get past that, we can resolve all these other important issues.
Right, exactly. And I think it's obviously essential that we make these connections to the bigger picture. There are people, in the Middle East, who are also concerned about the mistreatment of animals by humans. And so I don't think we should say that they aren't,
mm-hmm.
aren't concerned about it. But I think personally, from the research I've done and just seeing the way the media works and the way I believe our thinking works, that when we have a massive subterranean violence going on that's more or less hidden, the killing of millions of animals every single day, it creates a huge amount of violence that people are eating and causing, and that will then boomerang back into the culture in a whole range of ways. And that happens in every culture. I don't think it's, but in the United States, I think we're probably eating more meat per capita than almost any country in the world. And interestingly enough, we have other statistics, like we have more people incarcerated per capita than pretty much any country in the world
mm-hmm.
as well. And the largest military budget in the world also, and probably the biggest war machine.
People don't make those connections.
Right, exactly. And I think those are very important for us to realize that it's one thing that's very interesting, really, is that it's gotten now quite fashionable to make the connection that when we have people who are later very disturbed and commit acts of violence towards human beings, people who, shoot people and so forth, sort of mass killings, that they always practice on animals.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't gotten very obvious. Oh, yeah, they practice on animals when they're younger, when they're children or when they're younger. And yet we don't see that as a culture we are doing the same thing. We're practicing on animals on a massive scale and doing the same thing, and then we end up with massive war profiteering going on, and massive profiteering from pharmaceutical industry as well as from the meat, dairy, and egg industry. And I think more and more people are beginning to realize that they are complicit, in a sense, if they're eating animal foods, that they're causing this to happen in a very in a very direct way, and really harming themselves in a lot of ways too. Culturally, as well as physical health, but also culturally. There, for example, there's a group of people in Cincinnati who were inspired by the World Peace Diet, who are now doing World Peace Diet study groups through some of the progressive churches, and also through some of the especially one of the yoga studios, a couple of the yoga studios, and they have branched out also and created an outreach to churches, especially to ministries and go into these churches and especially to the ministers and show videos that make the connection between ill health and violence and eating animal foods. And very interesting to me that a couple of the churches, especially the ones that are African American, one in particular, the minister was really quite appalled. He made
mm-hmm.
the connections. He saw how the government has these programs in place to basically force inner city black kids to eat huge amounts of dairy and a lot of high processed animal foods that cause obesity and diabetes and all kinds of allergies and all kinds of disease, actually, as well as probably a lot of psychological problems to the children, and that it's a way of really oppressing his people. And he said, we have just got to get our entire congregation to go vegan. because that's the only way we're going to get our claim our power back again. That's the only way we're going to claim our own independence and our own freedom, is if we stop eating these foods of violence and oppression that are not only devastating, you know, and cruel to animals, but are the same thing to our, us and our children. And I think we have to start to realize that, you know, we have that our compassion for animals is really compassion for ourselves. Liberating animals is liberating ourselves. And they, the two go together. We will never be able to be free and healthy ourselves and to celebrate our lives the way we're, I think we're intended to on this planet, as long as we have this massive industrial killing machine of animals that causes enormous violence to them and causes huge numbers of human beings, our own brothers and sisters, not only to starve, but to work in the slaughterhouses. And
I've been thinking about this concept of freedom a lot in the last few weeks, and it's interesting that you brought up the story of this African-American minister.
Yeah.
Because you've probably heard this, you know, people say, I like my meat, and I want to eat what I want to eat. So often. And those people especially do not realize that they don't have free choice. They are not thinking. They have been totally manipulated by marketing to choose, to quote, choose the things that they want. It's not about freedom. It's about manipulation and marketing. And you probably don't watch any television, and I certainly don't watch a lot, but I heard about the show Mad Men, and so I've been renting some of the past seasons just because I wanted to know what all of this hype was about. And even though it's a fictional story, you get to understand how marketing started in this country and where we are today with it. And it's so subliminal, it's so huge, and it starts very young. These corporations get us when we're young. And we don't have freedom of choice. We are marketed and hypnotized and manipulated.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, that's, I think probably what you're saying is one of the absolutely most important things that any of us can not only understand, but to begin to articulate to others, because this is, I think, the most powerful way that we can actually spread a message of compassion and health and liberation, is to realize that when we meet anyone who's eating animal-based foods, that they are never in any way doing it out of their own free choice.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it really for only one reason, and that one reason is that they have been indoctrinated to do so by a huge range of forces, and a lot of the forces are like what you're saying, you know, the corporate marketing, but even, you know, and but beyond that, it's, you know, typically, like in my case, as soon as I lost my mother's breast, I started getting dairy, I started getting meat, I started getting eggs from the people that I totally trusted, my own mother and my my own father, my relatives, my grandparents, you know, everybody around me, my teacher, the minister, you know. So the corporations and corporate marketing is one aspect, but it's the entirety of this culture. Every institution is involved in this indoctrination and marketing of animal foods. So
you know,
that's what
there,
makes it so
I know that there are probably people listening, and plenty of people who aren't, that will say, no, I really love my food. And I'm going to say, you add sugar, salt, and fat to anything, and you can make it taste good.
Well, yeah, not only sugar, salt, and fat, but it's well known that most of the processed meats used in places like Kentucky Fried Chicken and all these places have huge amounts of MSG and other things that are very, you know, these taste enhancers that, especially for children, they make food taste bigger than life. And really, it's hard to get people off of that kind of stuff because it creates a certain craving.
Yeah.
And there's a lot. Plus, they found, Neil Barnardston researched that when these foods are, animal foods in general, especially cheese, but also tuna fish, a lot of other meats, they seem to create casomorphines, which are physically addictive as well. So there's multiple levels of addiction, I think, that are going on, like physical as well as just the idea. Remember when I was a little kid, I would come home from playing outside and I'd smell roast beef, and I'd know that meant my mother loved me because she was making a wonderful meal. And so if I don't smell roast beef, then somebody doesn't love me. You know, that there's these childhood sort of associations, and I think that are powerful. So when people say, like you're saying, when they say, "I love me," what is it that they really love? I think it's a lot of it is psychological. A lot of it is perhaps at some level of addiction, and a lot of it is simply their own self-image. And so in the World Peace Diet, I have a few chapters that kind of go into that and try to sort of deconstruct why we're actually eating animal foods, what it is that we really love about it. And I think the beauty of it is that we realize that it's not only possible, but it's not that difficult to make the changes, and that we will, within a few weeks, we will love the new foods that we're eating, because we're basically creatures of habit. So a lot of it is simply to find some way to have a support system, you know, other people. I think veganism is, on its own, is pretty easy to shift to a vegan diet. But the hard part most people have is really in the other people.
Dealing with their family and their work environment.
Workers, all these, where they're going to eat, restaurants, whatever it is. So that's what we focus on in the World Peace. I have a facilitator training program now that I've started doing, and I'm also a mastery program. And we talk a lot about how we can be effective advocates. And one of the big things is to help create community wherever people are, that to support them. Because without a community of at least a few other people you can talk to about things and get recipes from and so forth, people feel so alone and alienated. And we just don't want to feel that way as human beings. That's a big part of it.
I keep forgetting, because I'm at peace here in my home and with my family and with my food choices, and I do a lot of cooking, and it's all plant-based, and my world, everyone knows who I am and what I eat. They know I've been all about food for decades. But, you know, there are so many people out there that are just discovering, and it seems so hard to believe, especially when I've been in it for so long, that some people just don't know. But most people don't, and they do need support, and they do need help.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's really the key. You know, we have a tendency, since we've been in it for a long time, to assume that people are aware that, for example, a cow will not give milk unless she is impregnated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, I think that cows just give milk because that's what God made them to do.
Right.
That you have to steal the babies, and then you have to kill the babies and impregnate them again immediately. You know, otherwise they'll dry up. And so this, you know, huge underlying cruelty.
That is a very ugly story.
Right. It's completely invisible because people don't even think, and no one talks about these basic, you know, the basic truths underlying what's going on.
You know, I would think that I'm not a religious person, and I would think that the churches and synagogues would be the leaders in this compassion movement, and they're not.
Well,
you know,
right there
in the Ten Commandments is "Thou shalt not kill," and I talk a lot about, well, who are they talking about? But there are some particular groups. I know you speak to a number of different churches. The Unitarian, they've been moving a bit on opening this concept. You do speak at churches from time to time. Are there some that are more open to this and are more welcoming?
Right. Actually, virtually every single Sunday I am speaking in a church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mainly what we would call progressive churches, the most open-minded, liberal of the churches, mostly Unitarian churches and Unity churches.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, they are very, very much like typical liberal people. They enjoy a good steak, and they like to talk about how we should reduce the military budget. But in terms of actually changing their own diet, they'd rather change the subject. And so it's been pretty disappointing for me to see the degree of resistance in the progressive community to looking at the cruelty to animals for food and the cruelty to humans, really, for food. And it's made me, again, more aware of of how powerful the indoctrination is when it comes around food. Even people who are normally able to see past the indoctrination of our culture and don't just, you know, sort of go around thinking Americans are better than everybody and all that kind of stuff, they, when it comes to eating animal foods, they're maybe willing to give up red meat, but that's a huge accomplishment. And so they've, you know, like, for example, in the Unitarian movement here, in the whole denomination in North America, for the last 4 years, the focus has been, they take a study action issue, and the study action issue for the last 4 years, and it's supposed to end next year, 5 years and all, is ethical eating.
Mm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
So I thought, this is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Five years that hundreds upon hundreds, you know, literally, you know, tens of thousands of people are going to be focusing on ethical eating. Wow. You know, and yet I realize that their focus on ethical eating is limited typically to maybe something about, is it local or not, but the actual openness to looking at plant-based foods as a real powerful option is very similar to what it is in mainstream public. They resist, the ministers typically resist, and not to be cynical, I don't think I am cynical, but what I really do understand more and more is that a church, the way churches are run today, is essentially is they're run as businesses.
Yep.
In the sense that you know, they need to make sure that their customers are happy, that the message that they are getting is going to keep them coming back and giving generously to the church. And if you give a message that is upsetting to the people and they're going to reduce their giving or maybe, you know, not even come back or something like that, then you have a message that is just not going to be given.
Yeah.
That's pretty much how the World Peace Diet message or the vegan message is viewed by most ministers. And so it makes it quite difficult, actually.
Yeah, well, that's a message that's true not only in churches that are like businesses, but with actual businesses.
Right. And with businesses as well.
Yeah, everybody just wants to make sure the money keeps coming in.
Right, right. And it's a huge
It's
profit.
True with a lot of these chronic disease philanthropic organizations that,
right.
You know, we know that at least 60% of cancers could be prevented with diet and lifestyle. We know this and probably more. We know that prostate cancer can turn around by eliminating dairy products from the diet.
Right.
Dean Ornish did a great study. I mean, there are so many things that we know, diabetes and heart disease, we know that they're preventable. We know
right.
that they're reversible with
right.
diet. We know these things. And yet when these people have their fundraisers and their galas, they're serving up the food that creates these diseases.
Right.
Because so, that's what's going to bring in the big checks.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and most people who are eating these foods, even though they're not profiting directly, and in fact they're losing a lot of money, but they also would rather not know because they'd rather not think about the violence that they're actually causing. So there's several different angles that the cover-up continues. The motivation for the cover-up to continue is very powerful. So we're really having to appeal, I guess, primarily to the true, the basic physiological truths that will be a lot healthier eating a plant-based diet, and then to the ethical and moral dimension that anyone who has a dog or a cat knows that animals are capable of suffering, that they do have interests, that they are the subjects of their lives, and that harming them is unethical, you know, if we don't need to, obviously. And so these are really basic, obvious things, and yet we humans seem to have an amazing power to rationalize and blind ourselves to these things. And I think a lot of that is because of being raised in a culture where we're eating so many animal foods. We practice this. I think, honestly, I talk about this in the World Peace Diet, that I think every meal when we're growing up as children in households of eating animal-based foods, that every meal is really a ritual of disconnectedness, a ritual of elitism and privilege, and a ritual of domination of the inner feminine,
and numbing ourselves
yeah, right,
to
it
all
is.
The
it's
possible a feelings that we can have. We need to right. take a quick
sure.
break, Will, but we're going to be right back because we have so much more important things to talk about. We'll be right back.
Progressive Radio Network each day for the brightest progressive minds in the world.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off! I said not to play it!
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny!
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rood, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
This is Dr. Vicki. I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. We're proud to announce that the Progressive Radio Network will be bringing you our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, every Monday afternoon starting June the 6th from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Mark your calendars and save up your questions so you can ask us about possible strategies for your health problems, whether mainstream or complementary and alternative.
We also invite your questions and comments about any area of health care, including politics, economics, ethics, philosophy, and styles of healthcare.
So remember to tune in every Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to the Progressive Radio Network's Prescriptions for Health show.
Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for all things progressive.
Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. I am speaking with Dr. Will Tuttle, the author of The World Peace Diet, and he is a visionary, lecturer, musician, and a very, very beautiful person. Will, thank you for joining me, and let's continue about what we're talking about, this numbing that we all go through in order to live the lives that we do today. We see it in so many ways, not just obesity. People are really surrounding themselves with fat.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a desensitization process that we force all children to endure growing up in this culture, to disconnect from their natural feelings of compassion and kindness through forcing them to eat the flesh of the animals who have been hyper-confined and killed in very violent, cruel ways. And so we just would rather not think about, we would rather not feel, we'd rather not connect. And so we find a culture that has a huge obesity epidemic. I think that's that is symbolic, I think, of not wanting to feel and mm-hmm. covering ourselves over, but also huge amounts of drugs and other things that keep us from actually perceiving reality directly in addiction. There's a book I just read, I'm actually reading right now by Jane Velez Mitchell called Addict Nation. It's about the huge variety of different addictions that people in the United States are subject to, and it's basically covers the gamut from consumerism to pornography to drugs and alcohol, cigarettes, violence, crime, all kinds of different addictions that keep people sort of disconnected from the actual moment, you know, the actual presence and what they are, who they are, what they're doing. And I think that really the drive force behind all of that is the food and the mentality underlying food, which is of forcing us to disconnect from what we're doing to other living beings. And another part of that, I think, is PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something that is rampant in our culture. I'm starting to realize this. I talked about it somewhat in the World Peace Diet, but the basic work in our culture, which is done by so many people, agriculture and food, people who are working in the industry are committing such horrible acts of violence towards cows and pigs and chickens and turkeys and
every second.
Fish. Yeah, every second. And these people have PTSD. I mean, they are committing such violence and are in such violent environments. They not only have the highest rates of worker-related injuries, but also of suicide and drug addiction, alcoholism. And then when they go back home and back into their communities, their abuse of their of people, in their communities, of their wives and spouses, other people. And so this and then those people are traumatized, and it radiates out from there. And there's this ongoing web of violence that is continually reverberating, and then it gets picked up in the news media, and it gets, I think, we're continually being bombarded with images of violence and actual actions of violence because we're killing, in the United States, the conservative estimate is about 75 million animals every single day for food. So this is a huge project. It takes, whole armies of people who are and the numbers of people is very large because these are very short-term jobs typically, so they're turning over a lot. So there's a lot of people that have PTSD, and PTSD is, it just drives people into acts of senseless violence towards others, and or to suicide or to damaging behaviors. And this is the underlying price we're paying for the nice little saran wrap piece of flesh that we see when we go into a grocery store or when we order a prime rib or whatever. And I think that it's one of the main driving forces behind the wars that we're fighting, and which also create more PTSD and have more people coming back and committing violence. And I think this is a very hidden but enormously powerful dimension in our shared life here on this earth that we have to become aware of. And I think because of that, it's the inner feminine sensitivity that resides in both men and women is really repressed in our culture. And because it's repressed, we can do the kinds of things we're doing. We can send people off to kill other people. We can cut down the rainforest. I mean, the Amazonian rainforest now is being devastated at the rate, a conservative estimate of 1 acre per second, and that's been increasing very rapidly lately. And the driving force behind that is the same thing. It's to grow soybeans for animal feed and to cut down and clear for grazing, and the oceans are being all similarly basically devastated for fish to feed to animals. And I think we have to realize that the violence that we're inflicting on the ecosystem and on other living beings is always violence that will come back to us. So even if we, for some reason, don't feel a natural sense of kindness and compassion for animals or for starving people who are implicated, if we only care about ourselves, then I think we have to start making these connections and realizing that sooner or later it comes back to haunt us through some kind of illness. And, physical and psychological, all connected.
You meet many, many people, and you give your talk to so many different places.
Right.
Who are the ones that are hearing the message? Who are the ones where the veil is lifted and get it?
I think there's a lot of people who are right around college age seem to be and who are somehow predisposed to asking questions, are getting the message. I also find a lot of people who have been told, perhaps by their doctor or somebody who are older, that they should, or through their reading or whatever, that they should eat less meat. Then when they read the World Peace Diet, you know, or come to one of my lectures, they suddenly realize, oh my gosh, it's so much bigger than I ever imagined. And those people often become very highly motivated to spread the message as well. So I think there's a broad spectrum of people who are getting the message. I got an email not that long ago from a hunter in Oklahoma City, where we spoke there in Oklahoma, and he's even a writer for one of the hunting magazines, and he said, my wife and I went to your lecture, and we're now vegans.
Wow.
So I think that the potential, it's just someone who is able, for whatever reason, it's almost kind of harder to predict, to question the indoctrination, you know, someone who's able to do that. And I found it some, you know, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s can go vegan just as well as people in their 20s and 30s. And the people in their 20s and 30s sometimes seem to have, you know, a very strangely difficult time also to make the change. Because they've gone through a lot of, you know, they have gone through like 20 or 30 years of indoctrination anyway themselves, even if they're relatively young. So it's not only young progressive people. I mean, I'm seeing people of all walks of life making these changes, and it's just a matter. I think a lot of times it's a matter of hearing the message a few times. You know, more
absolutely.
Than just one.
Mm-hmm.
Got to hear it a few times, and it has to get in there past the usual defenses somehow. And so I always approach it myself that we're on the same side. I think that approaching anyone in any kind of a blaming way is not only counterproductive, but it really, in a sense, isn't true. All of us have been born into a culture that's forced us in so many ways to disconnect from our natural wisdom and compassion. And to remind people of that and to be their friend, to be on the same side with them rather than to be someone who's accusing them and blaming them and judging them is so much
sure.
More
I mean,
in alignment with the truth of the way it is. I
was a part of it. It was a long time ago, but I did eat meat.
Yeah.
I did eat dairy.
Right, and same with me. You know, I was born and raised in a typical family, eating huge amounts, and I was the older brother that basically forced my little sister to eat meat, and that was my job, get your protein. And
Does she eat meat now?
Yeah, the beautiful thing is that both my sister and my mother, who are very fundamentalist Christians, you know, we don't see eye to eye on that, but they're vegans, and now they've been vegans for about 15 years. And
very nice.
They're very committed, you know, especially my sister. She really understands it, even though, she's a fundamentalist Christian, where sometimes people think that those people are less likely to be vegan. But I've found, you know, quite often they can see that God, in their terms, you know, God would not want us to torture his creation, would not want us to harm beings that he has made, you know, that kind of thing. And I think, when they understand this, that they're very, very consequent and noble people, you know, really living an ethical life. And I think that's really what veganism is. It cuts across all religious and I think pretty much all philosophical boundaries, because it appeals to that part which is at the very root of the ethical impulse, at the root of the impulse to live in a sane,
I think when you think about it, there's no reason not to.
Right.
To subscribe to a vegan diet, plant-based diet.
Yeah.
There's no reason not to. I've got every argument. I don't like to use the word argument, but I have every reason. It's the best thing for the environment. It's the best thing for our health. You want taste? People that eat a plant-based diet, we are obsessed with our food. We love our food. We're all,
so
for
delicious.
The most part, big foodies.
Right. Yeah, no, really the only reason that seems to carry any weight at all is the historical argument, you know, that this is what we've done, this is what we've been doing, this is how we've lived. We've, you know, been eating meat, and I think we eat a lot, you know, probably a lot more meat than we normally ever have. But,
absolutely.
But that's not a, also is not a valid argument.
No.
Because you can say all kinds of terrible things we've always been doing, too.
Absolutely.
You know, use it for that reason. So it really is...
tradition is not a valid argument.
Right, right. And then the idea that you need it to be healthy, you know, I think that's another one that's probably the most difficult to counteract. If I meet someone who says, well, you know, I was a vegan for 5 years and I just didn't do well, so I have to eat meat, you know, my
mm-hmm.
doctor told me or whatever, you know, it's a little hard to argue with that in the sense that someone says, well, that was my experience and I wasn't healthy. However, I would still personally... I don't think it's true because I think, you know, we have to remember that these people are living in an ocean surrounded by other people who are eating animal foods. The medical people they go to for advice are saying, what, you're not eating meat? I mean, you know, where are you going to get your vitamin B12 and your omega-3s? And where are you going to get your protein, the amino acids you need, and your calcium? You know, you're really not being responsible. And so there's I wrote quite a bit about it in the World Peace Diet, the placebo effect, and how foods that we find to be disturbing or disgusting or mm-hmm. substances that way tend to make much better placebos. And I think there's we're starting to more and more realize that health is a very complex issue,
mm-hmm.
not just about food. I mean, food is one aspect, but it's how we're feeling about ourselves psychologically, and there's many, many different things involved. So I think if we're going to be vegans, which I hope everyone is, I think it's very important for us to eat a healthy vegan diet, to eat whole foods that are preferably organically grown and unprocessed and prepared with love and appreciation. That these are all, and then eaten slowly and mindfully. And you know, these are all important elements, as well as living a life where I'm basically happy, I'm doing work that I feel good about, because being a healthy person really requires, I think, a multidimensional approach, and eating a plant-based diet is certainly, I think, probably the biggest positive thing anyone can do. But there are many other things that very often I think vegans tend to ignore, and or people who are eating regular meals also tend to ignore. And so I want to encourage everyone to really be healthy, especially vegans. I think if we're vegans, it's really incumbent upon us to be healthy as examples and to
absolutely.
Take good care of ourselves and to cultivate a positive mental attitude, to take time every day to connect with the beauty that's in the world and in our own, perhaps take time to be creative or to meditate or to get beyond just the stresses of daily life. And
I believe that the vegan diet is the healthiest diet, but we don't have the data that supports that. What we do have is that a plant-based diet may be where at least 90% of our calories come from whole, fresh plant foods is
right.
the most healthy. But we don't know if we ate a little bit of animal products or none at all. We don't know
right.
if there's a difference. Okay, that's fine. I personally, for me, I don't want to have the animal foods.
Right.
And another thing that we don't know, I'm always suspect when I hear, and suspect and saddened when I hear people that say, oh, I was vegan, oh, I was vegetarian, and I didn't feel well, and I had to go back to eating animal foods. There's a part of me that says, you weren't eating the right foods, honey, and if I was feeding you, you'd feel a lot better.
Right.
You know, and there's this, I'm a real proponent of dark green leafy vegetables.
Right.
I think that the greens should be at the bottom of the pyramid. We all should be cramming greens, and people aren't.
Right, right, right.
And okay, so there's all of that. But we don't know this for sure, but it could be that some people who have been consuming animal foods for most of their lives have a certain metabolism that has accustomed itself to doing so, and when they start to eliminate those foods, they may have a physical problem. Oh, and, okay, so I can be compassionate about that, but I still believe that we should be getting most of our calories, at least 90% from plant foods, and that's everyone.
Right. Exactly. It's important to understand that when we switch to a plant-based diet, I think it's an incredibly important, positive thing to do, the body will naturally start to detoxify, and detoxification is usually experienced with some sort of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And people get a flu-like symptoms and start to clean out and the sore throat and different things and be low on energy. And then if they don't understand that that's what's happening, they may go ahead and start eating some cheese or some meat, and suddenly the symptoms stop, and they think, oh, I feel better now. Well, that's because they just stopped cleaning out, and they just, you know, the body was really doing something that was actually going to be much better in the long run if they had gone ahead and gone through with it. So there's that whole aspect of the natural cleansing that does take place, which many people don't understand, and the medical profession absolutely does not understand.
Oh, absolutely
either.
Not.
Yeah, and then the other aspect is we have to remember that, you know, I know in my own case, I think this is probably true for most people, I was told from the time basically I was born that if I didn't eat meat and dairy and eggs, I would probably not get enough protein, I'd probably not be healthy. And so we have to remember that we have these voices at a very deep level in our own consciousness, in our own minds, in our own cells, really almost at the cellular level. And it's important, I think, to consciously clean those out, to become aware that, yeah, these old voices, and we're surrounded by those voices, too. I mean, everywhere we look, we see billboards, and we see read articles that pretty much reinforce us, and we have attitudes and friends and family where they say, well, where are you going to get your protein, and where are you going to get this and that? And so I think it's very important to realize the psychological dimension of our own programming is very powerful. Our bodies, I think, are amazing instruments. They will pretty much, whatever you feed them, they'll do their best if they possibly can to adjust to it and to be healthy, and so you can live your life and accomplish what you're here to accomplish. So given all that, I think we have to realize the incredible power of our mind. I remember when I was a kid, you know, sometimes I didn't want to go to school, and I would say to my mom, you know, Mom, I don't feel good.
I
can't go to school today. And I would literally get a stomachache. I would convince myself, and pretty soon I had one. You know,
uh-huh.
If you have someone that's saying, I just don't feel good. I'm not getting my meat. You know, they can definitely manifest that.
Well, it's interesting what you said about the power of the mind and detoxing, and there's a whole bunch of things that come to my mind. Number one, when people don't feel well for a variety of reasons, sometimes they may just be tired and they say, I need to eat more protein. And it's just amusing
right.
the way people self-diagnose and often self-diagnose incorrectly. You know, sometimes
right.
when people feel tired, they need to sleep. You know,
right.
people don't get enough sleep, or maybe they don't get enough water. It's something really basic, something really simple, but sometimes they'll say, I need more protein, or if they're changing their diet, they may say, oh, you know, maybe I need to eat meat. And it's
right, and protein doesn't give energy. I mean, protein is much harder
to digest,
break down than the complex carbohydrates, which break down right to glucose for quick energy. And people, like you say, people self-diagnose that way, and it's complete. It's just a mythology,
so many of us know so little, and even the ones that know so much, we still know so little.
Doctors are basically, if doctors give nutritional advice, people don't even question it, and yet these doctors, where do they get their information? They're not taking any classes in medical school, so they're just getting it from the same place that the local car mechanic. So I usually say, you're better off going to your local car mechanic for nutritional advice than going to your doctor.
Right. And then the thing about detoxing, I really think there should be more on this subject, because there's a lot that the medical professionals don't talk about. Now, I have my own personal experience, and this is not exactly related, but kind of, at least opened my mind to it, and that is when I went through my cancer treatment a few years ago, I went through a bunch of chemotherapy rounds, and it took a year before all of that cleared out of my body. 1 year,
wow.
And nobody told me about this. I'm just really in tune, and
yeah.
I knew how great I felt before, and I knew that I had arthritis, stiffness in my hands and in my feet in the mornings when I would wake up, and I knew that was from the toxins that were in my body that took exactly a year to get out.
Right.
And so, you know, there are many people that they're changing their diet, and many of them can be very overweight, and there's a lot of toxins in their body, and it can
right.
take a long time
right.
while they've changed their diet where they're
right.
still not feeling the best. But on the other hand, the body is amazing, and it bounces.
Right.
It is so resilient.
Right.
And can,
yeah, that's really important to understand, because these toxins will sequester themselves away in the fat cells, and they'll be very often the last things to go when people finally start losing the weight going on a vegan diet. And you got to remember this, all those animals, all that animal food, all the cheese and eggs and yogurt and milk and flesh of animals, these animals were given all kinds of different hormones and things and antibiotics that also end up in our own sequestered away. And so that when that goes, that, you know, eventually that's going to want to go out. You're going to want to clean that out. And that's one of the, that's the point I wanted to emphasize too, is that as we travel around this country and we talk to so many people, the overwhelming sentiment I hear is people saying, when I went vegan, I just had so much more energy, I lost the extra weight, and I feel so much better. I mean, that's basically what 90%
of people say. Yeah, how many times have you heard that? So many times.
Yeah, that's the main thing. And, and then there will be some that will say, well, I had a hard time. But I think a lot of times the hard time was because they were cleansing, or they also had, they were seeing doctors who were not sympathetic. And I think that's very hard, because a lot of people really internalize whatever a medical professional says. They will really internalize it at a deep level, and they'll just, you know, it just becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. They'll say, "Well, the doctor said that, you know, I'm not getting enough protein, so I'm probably going to be low on energy." And sure enough, here I am, low on energy.
Right. Now, you travel around the country in your mobile home, and I assume you prepare a lot of your meals in your home.
All of them, yeah, all of them.
Yeah,
virtually.
So because people often talk about how challenging it is when they're on the road to eat well.
Right. Well, you know, when we only buy organic. That's actually the most challenging for us, since we're every single city we're in. Every weekend we're in a different city. So besides eating vegan food, we only eat organic and unprocessed whole foods.
Amen.
So it's so for us, I think it's probably, you know, we're the hardest of the hard actually. But we actually have to say, you know, when you just are dedicated to it, it's not that difficult.
I agree.
Open, you know, there's always, typically always, places where we can buy organically grown vegan foods, and, you know, like the local health food stores, and even the organic sections of regular grocery stores, if in a pinch. And then we have a refrigerator, and we store things. And my wife is Swiss, so she's very well organized, and she's always got plenty of stuff stored away in case of a rainy day, that kind of thing.
You can always find beans and rice,
right,
dried
beans,
foods that are organic.
Exactly, right.
That lasts forever.
You always have those, and you can always find, basically at this point, organic produce and fruits. And so we really, it's just like you say, we love our meals. They're just celebrations of absolutely most delicious food. And we have a chance also quite a bit to have dinners with people as we travel around. And, you know, they'll be like tonight, they're serving a dinner here at the church before, and the local people are making it, and so we get to experiment and see what people are doing, and it's really just fantastic to see.
Well, thank you. We've come to the end of the hour, believe it or not, and so I just wanted to remind people about your website, willtuttle.com, and if you haven't read The World Peace Diet, please pick up a copy. It will change your life. And if you have an opportunity to have Will come and speak at your church or your community center, he is everywhere and can get there. Thank you, Will.
Thanks so much, Karen, for the great work you're doing.
Yes, I hope I get to see you somewhere soon.
Yes.
Okay, thank you
great.
So much.
Okay.
I'm Karen Hartglass, and you've been listening to It's All About Food. And please check out my very brand shiny new website, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. Have a delicious week.